is that?
Come on, Mike.
It's all about how Bob has never played a game of Civilization. We must rectify this somehow.
don't you start on me. I have enough trouble. I have enough trouble with Metal Dog.
I suppose at some point we should welcome the audience to the latest episode of Mention and Dispatches with our good buddy Bob, who we've dragged out of bed for this.
And his cat.
Oh, really?
And his cat. We've dragged Bob and his cat out.
Branton must have told you a million times not to exaggerate.
Okay. Sure. A million and one. And yes. Then, of course, we have to have BB Mike on here because if Mike's not on here, it's not actually a podcast this season.
That's right. You can't have a co-host and not have the co-host show up.
or something like that.
Or something like that. And even a special podcast with Bob being on, I decided to start happy hour early. So it's double special.
So what we're really saying is that Brent was doubly desperate to not only get me.
I wasn't going to say that.
But to get Mike as well.
That's right.
When
he's at the bottom of the barrel.
E all fell through for the night. I had to go for Plan UK. So here you are.
There you go.
But shouldn't you be out digging snow or something?
No, that's Mike. I've just been getting rained on. Like,
oh, okay.
Yeah. We've had a bit of snow, but it only lasts for about 3 to 4 hours, and then it's just mud.
Since there's about a 10-day delay between when we record this and when it goes live, between now and then, we'll get a foot and a half, I'm sure.
And then it'll be 80 degrees.
It'll be utterly out of the forecast.
Don't you just love an optimist?
Well, that was Mike, you're laughing. That's been a legitimate concern because they were in non-pandemic times. The original plan was in February of this year, the Carolina Hurricanes here in town were supposed to play an outdoor game at Carter Finley Stadium here in town. That's the football stadium that NC State football uses. That's literally right across the parking lot from the arena where the Hurricanes play. They share the parking lots and everything. It's not even a long tee shot from one gate to the other. And they were supposed to play an outdoor game out there in February. They can get the ice out there. That's not going to be a problem. But everybody's like, wait a minute, you're going to do what outside in North Carolina? We're like, it's February, right? It could be 7 degrees. It could be 77 degrees, like in the same day. You know, we're just not really sure.
I remember those days when we used to go out. Someone remarked around here recently, said, my wheelie bin goes out more than I do.
Yes, back when we were allowed to leave our houses. Yeah. So I'm sure the audience doesn't want to hear us talking about the weather, though. So, look, both of you guys have managed to stumble across a little nobody publisher. Like, I don't want to say nobody because we're not going to pick on them. They are turning out some nice war games, and that is great. But
Vuka.
You're crossing the line, right, Bob? Is that what it was called?
Excellent.
And Mike, you picked up the Frederick the Great game?
The Great Crisis of Frederick II, which by the time this airs, I will have the first playthrough on the channel. So, yeah, I go on about – did an unboxing, too. I go on about how excellent the materials are that they use.
Yes.
You know, it's
components.
Components. That's the one. Thank you, Bob. Outstanding. Just outstanding components.
By the time this goes live, we'll be up to Frederick III. So.
Maybe. Yeah. So I'm really hoping to see new things from VUCA simulations.
So that's what I was going to ask is who's the company we're talking about? We got to make sure we get them out there.
They're called VUCA, which is a change of name from an obscure name that in Latin, I thought, wasn't it? Teutonicus Furoris or something. They changed the name. As Mike says, they've actually only got two games in public in print at the minute. The Frederick II game that Mike's looking at and Crossing the Line, which is about the Arkham campaign. Very, very well-produced games from a German publisher, as it happens. The only other thing I know is that they've got two more games slated to come out, hopefully this year, using the same base system as Crossing the Line, which is, I suppose you call it Grand Tactical. It's a battalion level game. Very, very good indeed. Obviously, a lot of thought gone into it.
Yeah. They hitting their website, they've got the two games that are live that you guys each have one of, and then they've also got five games that they're showing they're working on. They've got the two you mentioned, Bob. So they've got an East Front game and a Gazala, so North Africa game.
Yep.
And then there's a Wagram game, so Cyrano just fell out of his chair. And then there's there's a couple of air naval games.
Yes, there is. Yeah.
So they've got Red Strike, and then Mike will be happy. There's Task Force Carrier Battles in the Pacific.
Oh, there we go. Wow.
Yep.
I'm not sure if they've got a time scale on the other games, other than the two games that share the core system with Crossing the Line R, hopefully for publication this year.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what the website seems to indicate. For Crossing the Line, then, it's the Aachen campaign, so late in World War II.
Yep.
Allies have already marched across France, and now we're trying to get across the river.
I haven't seen very much about it. I think it's sort of come out of the blue. I only stumbled on it, to be honest with you. I was looking through the products that Second Chance Games in the UK keep. And, Andy, the guy who runs that shop for a lot of years, has specialised in more recent years in keeping stock from smaller publishers, mainly from the US, but from one or two other sources as well, that no one else in the UK keeps. And as I often do, I go browsing through what he's got, and I stumbled across that, and I thought, wow, this looks really interesting. Went onto the website, downloaded the raw envelope first, found there was already a Vassal mod for it, and it's one of the best Vassal mods I've ever actually played. And I was sort of won over from there. And I think he might have only had a couple of the games in stock because I bought one. And now I beat JD to it because I think he was tempted as well. And because he's got enough games he hasn't played as it is. And now it's out of stock. So I think I might have just stumbled on it in the right time and picked it up. And I can keep my eye on it now for the other games that come out in the series.
Some days you just better be lucky than good.
Pure chance that I stumbled across it, because like you say, I don't think hardly anyone's ever heard of them before, especially since unusually they're a European publisher, and there ain't that many of them about. I mean, there's that other crowd that you told me about, Brant, not so long ago, the Polish company.
Yep. TS War Games.
Strategy and tactic and strategy.
Yep.
But they haven't got anyone at the minute marketing those games in the UK. And they're remarkably cheap. They're something like €25 each, which is very, very cheap for a war game now, guys.
But yeah.
What I gather looking at a few articles that are on Board Games Geek is there's a few problems with rules translation from Polish, but the components generally seem to be quite good. Of course, the problem now with like buying stuff from Hexasim or anywhere else in Europe now, because of the stupidity of what being through with Brexit and whatever, it's very uncertain about buying stuff now from Europe.
Yep.
Which is crazy. I mean, I tried to get something not so long ago from Hexasim, as did JD, and we both got messages back saying that it's unclear what they have to do in order to sell to the UK. There will be added costs, VAT, whatever, but they don't know what those costs are yet, and therefore they couldn't accept any orders from the UK. So
that's crazy.
You know, it's hurting a lot of people.
Yeah, at least we know here that if we're sending games to Canada, that the price doubles for Vance.
Yes.
Thanks to the shipping costs. But at least it's a predictable doubling, right?
That's it, exactly. But there again, you see, you've got Andy at Second Chance Games is only one of very few bricks and mortar war game shops that still seem to be in existence. Andy is importing a lot of stuff from all the American publishers. And then you've got people like Andy Lokes at Limey Yank Games, who, if you pre-order something with MMP or GMT, they will ship them in probably through Andy Lokes. And he's got a thing whereby it offsets a lot of the shipping costs. And he calls it European-friendly shipping.
Yep, because he can accept stuff in bulk.
Yeah, and Andy's been doing that for quite a long time, you know.
Yeah.
But it doesn't cover everybody, and it's got to be a pre-order. It's got to be something that, you know, you've ordered in advance.
It's kind of like when I, with the VUCA simulations game, Bob, I actually had to go find somebody here in the States that had that game and ended up finding a small place, I guess, in, where were they? Let me look real quick. I think they were in Mississippi Vicksburg, Mississippi, and they had it, and I ordered it, and that's how I had to get it.
It's very strange that nobody else that I know of has ever stumbled across them, especially Doug. I'm surprised Doug didn't pick it because you know what he's like.
Well, but this one, it might be a little too high level for like a Doug or a Jim.
There's no hexes on the map, so I'm curious about Doug's true love of it.
And honestly, it's outside of my I'm normally not a point-to-point person.
No, I'm not sure.
It's very high-level strategic, but this one is so unique that it's just fun. And I think it's a great introduction to wargaming. I think if you wanted to introduce someone to wargaming, that this would be a good start.
Really?
It's that much fun.
Yeah, hexes are just equal-sized points.
That's true.
That are all equidistant.
Yeah.
I will say, so the maps and counters for both of those games do look excellent. I mean, they
do, yeah.
They really are.
You guys will have to testify to the component quality, but the visuals of them are stunning. Yeah,
the other thing that I was quite impressed with is that obviously one of the guys, at least from the company, from the publisher, is very active on BGG. And a couple of questions that I asked were answered, or other people asked, were answered very, very quickly.
It's
always a good sign, I think. They've got a lasting, long-term interest in the games that they're publishing. And there was one or two little sort of anomalies with the rules that were, I think, again, were just a matter of translation.
Yeah.
Not everything always translates over. They've been pointed out what they mean, you think, right, that's fine. You know, it's very good. I think, you know, that level of support, I think, is something which is very, very welcome, because there are some companies with games and they never seem to take any post-publication interest in them at all.
Yeah, and I have to say that the rules for the Frederick gamer were pretty tight to start off with. They did do an errata, but it was a very small errata, and the rules were pretty tight.
Well, I printed it out, and I think it was just, one two-sided pages. One two-sided A4 sheet. And there was nothing really. I think one of them is only about setup, and I know something about, there was a couple of three counters which had been misprinted, which I might add, a very good friend of mine is actually sending me in the post because they were included with the other game.
Now, that is one thing that I thought was kind of odd, and I hope that's not their approach to correcting counters, because you would be forced to buy a game you really don't want just to get corrected counters. And that's why I offered it up on the forums, because I'm going through, you know, my counters and pulling them off the sprues, and I see these three, and I'm like, well, what is this? These look like nothing.
There's no tank battalions in Frederick's day.
Exactly. I mean, they have actually got a PDF file on their site with those replacement counters, so you could do a print and play yourself if you wanted to. So they have at least provided some method of being able to people producing the counters. And to be honest with you, they're not critical counters.
That's good, because I still have an action item to get out and get these into the post, and with the delays, you'll probably
see them. Bob can't leave his house to go to the mailbox to get them anyway.
Well, what you do, Mikey, you get an envelope.
Mike, I hear what you're saying about putting counters for one game in another game is a little odd. And to that extent, I do agree with you in terms of like an actual formal game. The flip side of it is, I mean, magazine dudes have been doing that forever.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, when was the last time you saw a game edition of an S&T or a C3I that didn't have like 17 counters for 9 other games sort of filling in the gaps around what was needed for that issue's game?
And I think that's a good use games as well.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a good use of the counter sheets, especially if you've already got a couple of spaces that you're not using anyway, rather than just a handful of random blanks. Although, to be fair, most of us could probably use a random blank to, you know, pen and ink something that we've lost along the way. But I do think it's a good use of either variant or corrected counters or something like that.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think, and so with, you know, modern day, of course, I'm an older wargamer. Modern day times, you can do what I did. And if you don't have that game, you can go to a forum and say, hey, I've got these extra counters. Do you have this game? Would you like them? So yeah, certainly it's, instead of having a blank counter, I agree. It's good for that, I think.
I think it was much more difficult to correct in the old days, as it were, before we had the ability to print stuff out ourselves.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You bought a game and that was it. If the counters were wrong or there was errors on it, you were stuck. Really, there was very little you can do about it. But at least we do now have the technology to correct a lot of these things without an awful lot of difficulties. You know, it's not that hard to print something out and cut out a few counters. It might not be as good as the originals, but at least it's better than nothing, I suppose.
Yeah.
Just because I was curious, I grabbed my copy of C3I number 29 off the shelf here. This is the one with the Plan Orange game in it. It's the Pacific War between 32 and 35, so it's sort of the prequel to Empire of the Sun.
All right.
If you will. And it's, again, it's a very stripped down version of the Empire of the Sun rules. There's a lot that's not in there because it's a much smaller scale and scope. But just looking at the counter sheet in there, you've got the boats for the U.S. and the Japanese, and you've got the different land forces on there. But then there are counters on here for Pensacola, Germantown, Savannah, and Brandywine from the American Revolution games. There's stuff in here for Blue Cross White Ensign, Chariots of Fire, for Sardes. There's a whole bunch of Wing Leader counters on here. There's one stray Elysia counter in here. So there's plenty of extra stuff floating around this counter sheet, which, again, you know, it's a good use of having the space available on the counter sheet. There's one that's not labeled for what game it is on the counter sheet like the others are, but I'm pretty sure General Hooker did not fight in the Pacific in between 32 and 35. It just doesn't tell you which game that one's for.
Because the annoying thing is, an experience I had, which I'm sure you'll remember, Brent, is when you get a copy of a game where it's actually short of markers to play the game.
Yeah.
But instead, they've actually got counters for another game, correct, you know, errata counters for another published game, but they don't actually tell you which game it's for.
Yeah.
And you still think about, I really could have done with those if they had printed out more markers for the game it was with. And that, I think, was very, very annoying indeed. But the publisher in question, which we'll not name, is not one of my favorite companies.
Yeah, which is... You know, the whole thing there is, if you're going to put it, if you've got the space, you know, fill it with the counters you need for your game before you start putting errata in there for something else. I don't think that's an unreasonable ask. I will say, so this was 15-ish years ago. Some folks really like the games from Avalanche Press. Some people really hate the games from Avalanche Press. I'm not here to necessarily talk about the relative quality of the stuff Avalanche does, but something that I did like and still do enjoy on Avalanche Press's website, they do they have daily bonus content where they run a small article every day about one of their games somewhere, and usually tie it into some sort of scenario or something that they're doing on sale. And in some of the historical articles that go with the different variants are a blast to read. Some of them are a whole lot of fun. They had one some number of years ago that so they had a couple of different games, and they may all be out of print by now. They were the smaller box format that were essentially World War II West Front battalion-level games as the U.S. were marching across.
The little Sicily game they did was not bad.
Yeah, yeah. So there was the Sicily ones. And I don't know if these were the same system or not, but there was a Bulge game in there. Of course, there was a Bulge game, right? There's always a Bulge game. But there was... There were a couple of these, and like America Triumphant, I think, was one of them. Not a bad little system. The maps were hideous. The maps were physically painful to look at. But the counters weren't bad. The rules were okay. It was a decent game. It's just the maps were real pain. So these were battalion level counters, and they released a handful of different variants that were the articles behind them were also quite entertaining as well.
Yeah.
And one of the articles was about this. This infantry battalion that the U.S. Army tried to raise that was an Austro-Hungarian battalion of sort of refugees and expats. But basically, it was anybody, when people were volunteering to join the U.S. Army to go overseas and go, you know, fight the Nazis, pretty much if you're if whatever birth information you had was anywhere within what was the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time, they sort of threw you in one place together into this unit, assuming that, oh, these are all a bunch of Austro-Hungarians. Never mind the fact that the Habsburg Empire was like 12 different, you know, sort of proto-nationalities all slammed together.
We weren't renowned for getting on very well, Chuddy.
Exactly. And all of these guys were all, you know, old. They were old enough that they, you know, even if you were born in 1916, you know, in 1936, you're 20. So, you know, these guys are all in their mid-20s. And you know, you could have been in what was now Czechoslovakia or whatever else as a part of this birth certificate. So they threw all these guys into one unit together. None of them got along with each other. And none of them really wanted to go fight because they all thought that it was all about the restoration of the Habsburg monarchy, because the U.S. military never made it all that clear that wasn't what they were doing.
No.
And the title of the article about this unit was, you know, the something, I think it was like the 101st Provisional Infantry Battalion or something like that, but it was the U.S. Army's Bucket of Nothing, which I always thought was a great name. So they created a variant counter that you could download. As far as I know, this thing's still on Avalanche's website. I'm just too lazy to go look it up, but I think it's like a zero strength infantry battalion. It just sort of, it goes on the map and takes up space, and, you know. But to my knowledge, they never printed one of these in any of the games. They just sort of made it available to you if you wanted to download it and print it.
I bet there was a queue.
Yeah. They had a German counter that actually had a Sherman tank on it, because there was a German unit in the Bulge that put together a whole bunch of captured Shermans.
Well, it was the 150th Panzergrenadier, the Trojan Horse.
Yes, they tried to infiltrate the Allied lines. And
Otto's Skorzenzi.
Yes. Yes, that was them. And so they had a counter for that one. They had a counter for a Norwegian infantry battalion that a whole bunch of Norwegian expats and refugees and whatever were hoping to retake Norway. Because remember, Norway was the one country that was never liberated from the Nazis. And so they were hoping they'd get a chance to go try and take Norway back, except for whatever reason, like the Allies never really legitimately entertained thoughts of trying to reconquer Norway, because it was going to be a real pain in the butt, not to much strategic advantage. And so these guys ended up getting thrown in to the Bulge just when they needed reinforcements. They just needed bodies to fill the line. They threw these guys into the Bulge. And so they're in the line in the Bulge trying to hold the line. And here comes Skorzeny's dudes down the road in their Sherman tanks. And they're yelling in English at these Norwegians, surrender or die. And Skorzeny had the dumb luck to run into the only non-English speaking battalion in the U.S. Army. And so Avalanche Press has this whole series of articles about these dudes and counters for all of them that you can make to include into your games if you want. Oh, so you can... you can put the Norwegian infantry battalion in there. You can put the Sherman-equipped German tank battalion into there if you want. So, I mean, it's fun when people get some variants like that in place.
Funny enough, as it happens, I'm just at the minute reading A Time for Trumpets by Charles B. MacDonald.
Okay.
And it's about the Bulge, obviously, that's what the game is. And funny enough, the chapter I've just been reading today is about the 150th Panzer Brigade. Trojan horse. And he was saying that at one point they'd said Skorzenzi was actually horrified because this thing had been cloaked in so much secrecy that even most of the high command in Germany didn't know about the operation. And that somebody put a message around, oh, we need anybody who's an English speaker and they can do an American accent. Any captured American equipment, bring it all here. It's for a special mission. And because all the G2s and all the divisions on the Allied side are going, what?
Yeah.
And it turned out they had something like, no, I don't know, 37 Jeeps. They had quite a few Shermans, all of which broke down apart from three. So they had to resort in trying to disguise. They got a few Panthers and a couple of M10s and disguised them up. And Skorzenzi said, well, if they're good enough to fool a green Horn, who has never seen a Sherman tank before, as long as it's at night and they're about 3 miles away, nobody will ever notice.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was horrified that the whole secrecy thing had been blown by this request going around every unit asking for captured American equipment and people who could speak English.
Yeah. Yeah, like the Americans aren't going to get wind of it and figure this out.
Well,
yeah.
Reading it now, the intelligence side of it is that there were so many things, if they'd have put them all together, and one or two people did actually say, there's something strange going on in the Ardennes, in the Schnee Eiffel. And everyone's going, no, no, no. Everybody thought what was happening was that these reserves were being pulled together to counterattack. They knew that... the Americans were about to launch a big offensive to capture the Ruhr dams.
Yeah.
The big thrust. And so the cover story was encouraged that all the reserves are being collected as a counterattack to meet that. But when you look at all the picture afterwards, I suppose it's easy to be wise after the event. There were so many intelligence pointing to the fact that there was something going to happen in the Ardennes. And no one really took any notice.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so amazing how often we've known and then just ignored it because it didn't suit our purposes.
It didn't suit it. No, that's exactly right. Exactly right.
And so, audience, if you're still with us, this is exactly why you want those alternate counters on those counters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. There you go. Say no more. If anyone's interested, certainly this period, it's well worth reading the MacDonald books because he was sort of an official historian. I've just read his book on the battles for the West War and for Arkham to go along, funnily enough, with the Crossing the Line game. I wanted to know a bit more about it. And he's obviously got quite a few books out, and they're excellent. Well, if you haven't read them, I would highly recommend it.
One of my favorite World War II books, and I haven't read nearly as many as you guys, but one of my favorite World War II books I actually read 20 mumble years ago when I had some downtime out in the field with my first active duty unit. Somewhere along the way, I picked up a copy of The Last 100 Days, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's The Last 100 Days of the War in Europe. And and you don't get a ton of depth in any one place, but you get a lot of personal stories across the breadth of the Western Front.
Yeah.
And he dabbles some in the Eastern Front, but it's clear that the U.S. and Brits are the main thing that he knows. And it's a great read. It's a good skip about the Allied forces across the entire Western Front. Yeah. With a lot of very good personal stories, very low level individual dudes. This is what was going on with us.
Yeah.
The crossing of the river.
It's been a lot of years since I read that, I tell you.
Yeah. I really enjoyed that book a lot. And it's an easy read. It's not one that really taxes you to sit down and enjoy. It reads quick. The prose is clear. It flows. It moves quickly. I really enjoyed that particular book. About the Western Front. So that's for someone looking for one. It starts primarily after the bulge has been blunted.
Yeah.
But it's a good read. It's a good read. I would recommend it.
Yes, so it's, I have read it, but it's been more years ago than I care to remember. But I think one of the things that impressed me about it was all these small pictures that they say it's a typical thing that everyone sees their own small part.
Yep.
And to try and build up a picture from all these personal narratives to build up a bigger picture. And how often that one person's experience, even in a relatively small area, can be totally different from what somebody else sees who is in the same battle or the same, part of the front. Is that everyone's got their own perception of what they actually saw or what they interpret the things that they saw. And I think that was a fascinating thing about that book, because all the different experiences, very individualistic.
Yeah, absolutely. Toland has written a variety of books like that. Most of his are like that. That just happens to be the one I enjoyed the most amongst the list. So, Bob, you had posted online where you and I think it was JD were trying to get a vassal game of Crossing the Line together. Did that ever come together? Did y'all make it very far?
No, it didn't. In fact, I'm waiting for him to pick it back up again. In fact, we got as far as putting the vassal mod up. And I think tuner, Charlie was sort of came in. We did it through my Discord channel. And for some reason, we couldn't get us both into the same room at the same time. And I think at the last minute, Charlie actually spotted something we were doing wrong. But by then, the time had flown. And so JD said, look, okay, we'll start again. And it's sort of hung there. So I'm really waiting for JD to pick it back up again.
Remember when technology was going to make all this stuff easy for us?
Yes. Well, Brant, it was like I was saying afterwards that what I can remember, again, playing PBEM, the original combat missions with one of my buddies, and we were like backwards and forwards all night with emails, and it was brilliant. You know, and that was the technology, wasn't it? You know.
Yeah, I remember some. This is going back some number of years, right? Because I'm talking about Civilization II. But I can remember some pretty good hot seat games with Civ II before everybody was wired up, where everybody could be online and playing head to head. You would get some hot seat games going, and there was sort of a magic number. Like if you got above four players, there was just too much downtime between players. To make it worth sort of sticking around waiting for your turn again. So you'd sort of cap the games at either three or four people playing hot seat with you so that nobody got too bored.
Did you ever play a game called Laser Squad?
I did not.
Oh, I've heard of that. I don't think I ever
that,
played it.
That was a hot seat game. That was absolutely superb. I think we used to play it on, it may not have been the Commodore 64, it was probably the Amiga. And that was, took a lot of hours of our time of playing hot seats.
Surely you're just making up computer names, Bob. No, I'm kidding.
No, I'm not. Well, just sitting.
We're behind, all old enough to remember those.
I'll tell you what, sitting behind me there is my dear wife. She's sitting there playing World of Warcraft, but she will fondly remember when we first got our Commodore 64, sitting up until dawn, which is obviously before we had kids, playing Drop Zone, didn't we, dear? And that was a hot seat game. And I say, good grief, is that the time? It's starting to get light. And, you know, there's a couple of three games like that. We were a lot younger then, obviously.
I was like that in college with Civ 1, where I would, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, homework's done, kind of winding down, put a little music on, start playing a game. Ah, crap, man, the sun's coming up. I got to get up.
Yeah.
That happened a few times.
Yeah. It's even worse when you do that with a board game. Again, going back, I probably related the time before when there was probably a little group of us, sort of an unofficial war games club, if you like. There was about six, seven of us. And my good buddy Gary, who I've still been playing 40 years war game, he had a room where it was dedicated to just war games. He had space to do it. And we had set up, as if you remember the Europa series, we had Scorched, Fire in the East and Scorched Earth all set up. And there was just about enough room to squeeze round between. Well, he had tables with it all on. It was so big. I think there was five of us were playing. We had three Germans who were playing Army Group North, Central and South, had a player each, and two Russians. And it took, we would perhaps start off 7:30 on an evening, and we'd still be there maybe 2-3 o'clock the next morning, and we would get through half a game turn.
Yeah, Fire in the East alone is enormous. So I can't
Well, we'll add Scorched Earth onto that as well, and you'll remember how big it is. So
that's crazy. Mike, I wanted to ask, because I'm going to ask Bob too, but we'll start with you. What's a game you've tried lately or that you've played with lately that is out of your comfort zone, something that's not in a genre or a topic or a historical period that you would normally just sort of automatically go to? What's something you've poked around at lately that you would otherwise avoid?
I don't know. I haven't played anything like that personally. I would say it's not true to say I've got a narrow field of periods that I like, but I would not normally play anything that was later than Vietnam or maybe French Indochina, and anything perhaps earlier than Renaissance. So
as long as there's gunpowder and no computers, you're okay.
Right. Yeah, all right then. Again, you see, when you got people like, when you're friends with people like Doug, who has introduced me to so many periods that I was not familiar with, sort of 17th, 18th century things, which I'd never really looked at before, I suddenly found that there's a lot of periods that I've suddenly become very interested
in. Yeah.
But especially with his involvement with Horse and Musket, which he got me into, and we played that, and I've got a copy of that. And it's fascinating stuff. But when you go sort of into this, your type of games really branch, you know, you look at the 1985 What If scenarios and games in Europe,
yeah.
NATO, Warsaw Pact. I have played stuff like that in the past. I think we had SPI's Next War, the Central Front series, if you remember that from the SPI.
I know it well.
Yeah, and we played them all, but they never sort of really grabbed me the way, I don't know, Second World War or American Civil War, which always been a big spot for me. What more recently I've found I've actually got a real fascination with is the period that goes from probably 1854 until 1871. So you're covering like the wars with Denmark, the German-Austrian War, the Prussian-Austrian War, the Franco-Prussian War. There's that little period of European history, which I find absolutely, totally fascinating.
Hmm. Mike, what about you? Something off the beaten path that...
Bob actually mentioned it. And for me, it's Horse and Musket, the dawn of a new era. It's a period that I just never had much interest in. And really, the only reason that I checked it out was I had played Command and Colors, and I knew that this was similar to the mechanics.
Yes.
And I ended up liking Horse and Musket much better than Command and Colors.
Yep.
I like the cap system in there. And so I went so far as to not only order, because I had bought the PDF version, the print and play version, and
yeah.
put it into Tabletop Simulator, but I liked it so much, I bought the hard copy version. So it's actually, you know, it's on my table. And it got me interested to the point where I went back and I owned Pike and Shot from, I think it's Matrix Games, an older game that led to their Field of Glory games, I guess, yeah. their Field of Glory 2. And I went back and installed it and had a great time.
I mean, especially with the expansions for it, all there's so many scenarios now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think the original Horse and Musket, the Dawn of an Era, starts off with the last siege of Vienna,
yeah,
and goes through to the Seven Years' War. So
yeah, I'm really looking forward to Volume 4, which I think is supposed to come out this spring, I believe. They get into Revolutionary War type stuff. So I'm really looking forward to that.
You know, we had a podcast with Doug and Tom on it talking about
it. Was a very good episode too.
Yeah. Yeah. They would have been telling you when those new ones were coming out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, I haven't really looked at the one there, which is Horse and Flintlock, so which covers English Civil War and the 30 Years War. But again, there's so many scenarios. There's such a lot of scope in that period, you know, with the number of armies and the things you can do. It's a very clever game system.
Yeah.
Because at first you look at it and you think, I'm not really sure like the anonymity of the units, you know, they're just... What are they? What do they mean? What scale is it? But very cleverly, I think the designer left that flexible.
Yep.
Because and so you can accommodate all these different armies and periods within the mechanics of the game and still make it work. You know, it is actually a very, very clever system.
Yeah, yeah, that was all by intent, so that you know you had a sandbox to play in. So there you go. But no, I was just curious because we all have kind of our sweet spots that we happen to really like and really enjoy. And so, you know, how far afield are you willing to go to get to that? And for some people, they're always willing to get outside their comfort zone. Other folks, you know, nope, not going to do it. So
no.
It was the Austerlitz game that I got to play in on Wednesday nights right back before Christmas when I joined Jim and the gang for the Austerlitz game that was a part of Wednesday Night Warfare. And so that was a lot of fun. And I'm not generally a big fan of Napoleonic stuff. The stuff that I normally play a lot of. And so, you know, I'm glad Jim was willing to sort of help walk a guy who wasn't sure what he was doing through a bunch of those. And fortunately, I had Dalinor on my side to help shepherd me through some of that. look, the point at which Velker's kicking your ass with his patented die rolls, it really doesn't matter how good or how bad you think you're doing. You're just going to run into him and get your ass kicked. So there's always that as the caveat. But it it was nice to be able to join one of those evening games where I'm usually just a spectator because I'm working on Saturday nights. So it was nice to be able to join and play for a couple of weeks. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the French started doing a lot better once I wasn't able there in command.
I went back and watched that clip of Velker rolling those dice. And I think you said it, Brand, that it was one of those moments in gaming that you're going to look back on one day with your beer and say, here's what happened.
It was so impressive. I was
just like, oh my gosh.
and I don't recall if I actually verbalized it on the video or not, but I could kind of feel it coming. I was like, I'm about to get
no you did verbalize it on the video. You did.
Yeah.
You saw it coming pretty clear.
I can tell this is what's going to happen.
Yeah, you actually pointed that out.
No matter what the odds, Velker's about to whip my ass. So
one thing I like about the stuff that Jim does is Jim's sheer enthusiasm
for
everything
yes.
he does, and he projects. And I think Velker's obviously picked it up, you know, like father, yes. like son. But Jim's enthusiasm and his knowledge and his willingness to create things and get stuck in and do it is just, I just think he's so creative. It is an inspiration, really.
Yeah,
and that whole, you know, war gamer
art of the year, right?
There you go. I was going to say the whole reason. There you go. That's exactly why. It's just his enthusiasm and his knowledge. It's amazing.
It's almost like he paid us to say that.
Almost. Actually, we're supposed to get our Grognard of the Year mugs next week. Is that what he said we would?
Is that when we're supposed to get them? For campaigning on his behalf? I do think it was well earned on his part. And
folks
heard the podcast a couple weeks ago when we were talking about it, when I finally brought it up to him at the end of the podcast, you could sort of tell he was a little embarrassed by it, but no reason to be. He's done a ton for people over the last 12 months. So, well, the last 10 months of the pandemic, especially when people sort of had to adjust to that. But fortunately, by then he was well underway with being able to bring these things. And that was good. That was good.
I think, you know, within our sphere, I can't think of anyone else that's come anywhere close to promoting the hobby and projecting it in such an interesting way as Jim has done, as you say, especially over the last 12 months.
Absolutely. It's been a lot of fun.
I would take my outrageous hat off to him if I had one.
So, Bob, aside from trying to get Crossing the Line working on Vassal with your boy JD, what is the next thing that is hitting the table or the screen over there in Bob land?
There's not much on the screen. I'm not a great one for war games as such on the computer these days. I'm still very much like the physical components. Doug's talking again about trying to do something with Scourge of War for Gettysburg, which I have got. So that may be something I get dragged into kicking and screaming, I must admit. I've also got a copy here, which I was very fortunate to have been given as a present, of GMT's The Spanish Civil War, which has been very, very long out of print.
Interesting.
And that was a gift. It was from a friend last year, and I've tinkered about with it. And it's got a scenario in there for Operation Felix, which, as you probably know, was a projected possible invasion of Spain and Portugal by Hitler. Obviously, he wanted to wrest control of Gibraltar away and close off the Med. And I keep promising myself I'm going to get that sorted out and put on the table at some point. So that's sort of a project I've got. And I'm also really, really interested at some point in playing the Shell campaign, which is another one.
I've never heard of that. That's an interesting. Tell us about that one.
which is another game by Thomas Hollingspiel. And all I need, really, I'm just desperate to find someone who's willing to learn to play with me. You know,
so. You know, it's interesting you mentioned that because it wasn't that long ago. I bought a print and play copy of that and put it into Tabletop Simulator. So if I'd known this, you know, we need to get together and figure out when we can maybe play.
Really, Michael? Well, there's a coincidence.
You saw this coming.
Well, blimey.
So, yeah, we got to work on that.
but yes, again, it's a Brian Train game, and it's got a very interesting little system. It's a campaign which I've had a fascination with for a long time. So one day I'm going to try and do something a bit more in-depth with that.
One day.
Sooner or later. One day. Eventually, it'll happen. So, Mike, right now we've got Blitz, A World in Conflict, running in the My Own Worst Enemy series that we've been running on the Armchair Dragoons, and you've got some Horse and Musket stuff you've been noodling around with. But are you done with Blitz, and we're just waiting for the rest of the videos to get out there, or are you still playing Blitz, and we're just not quite all the way through them yet?
So it sounds like you didn't see the last episode. I actually realized that I made a pretty major mistake at the end of the first turn, in that I forgot to do something with each major power, and where they were supposed to actually acquire some new units, and it has a pretty big impact on the game. So I put it out to the viewers. Let me know what you want me to do. Should I just throw this thing aside? Should I start completely over? Should I keep going and just kind of muddle my way through? From the looks of things, the responses I've got, which are zero, I think I'm just going to probably have to restart the game later on. I do want to play an entire game of it, so I think I'm going to just stop here and restart it from scratch later on.
Yeah, I did not. I didn't see the look, man. I just publish them. I don't watch them.
There you go.
I've watched most of up until this last one. So Horse and Musket's the next thing that you're going after here?
Well, no, I did publish, and I posted a playthrough of Horse and Musket. That's two playthroughs I've done now with that one. So tomorrow morning, of course, like I said, by the time this thing goes live, it'll already be out there. The first episode of The Great Crisis of Frederick II goes live. So I'm going to start a playthrough of that on the actual physical table, not Tabletop Simulator.
Okay. No. Okay. You're not going to drop the camera on this one, are you?
I think I've got a system now where that's not going to happen again. In fact, this is the first time I'm trying a two camera thing, so it should be interesting. It worked out pretty good, actually.
Whoa, okay.
It's good stuff, though, Mike. The My Own Worst Enemy things is I really enjoy watching those. I think you're doing, again, it's the enthusiasm of projecting what you do is very good, especially for people who, most of us, used to have been playing most of our games solo.
Yeah, I think I'm getting better. We're approaching a year. It's hard to believe. If I go back and look at those first couple of videos, I sound like I'm a hostage reading from prepared statement and those things. But I think I'm getting better, and I think my technology's improved, and I'm a lot more comfortable doing it now. So I'm hoping that they're getting a little better.
No, they're getting good. They're getting there, so you actually look forward to them. But one of the interesting things about solo gaming is, and come across this a few times, is you can play a game solo and you think that you really know it, and then you play someone else against it and they suddenly point out things that you've either misinterpreted or missed, and you think,
absolutely,
oh, I never spotted that. And they think, oh, that someone's shown you a different interpretation of a rule, and you realize that this game, which you know so well and you've played and played, is you've been doing it wrong.
Yeah.
And I've actually, and it's one of the pitfalls of playing solo games, is that once you've got into a groove of doing something wrong because you've misread it or whatever, then that's it. It's there all the time.
At the same time, though, you seldom get into rules arguments with yourself. So if you're doing it wrong, it doesn't matter.
That's really paranoid, isn't it? Yeah, but
it really is.
There's at least neither one of you have got the advantage, though, have you?
Yeah. And I was watching, I think it was the Player Aids guys. They released a video not too long ago where they had their outtakes, and it was hilarious. And I was thinking, if I ever release one of these things, something's wrong.
one of your outtakes.
Yeah, of me arguing with myself or making myself laugh.
There you go. The next thing, so I've still got the White Tribe on the table as we are recording this. although I'm a little over a third of the way through the game. I'll probably finish it this week, and then I got to figure out what's next. I've actually was digging around through some of the archives here at some of the older magazine games and folio games that I have, just to see some of the older stuff that I've got, and there's a variety of things that I've got. I'm like, man, I should really push that around for a little bit. So I may get some of those out and poke around with some of them for a little bit, since I still have a little bit of free time before the new job starts. But I've also got the design project that Tolstoy and I have been working on in the forums. And so at some point, I've got to actually mock up some physical components to that and start trying to push those around and see if the ideas that we're talking about actually translate onto the tabletop. Worth a darn. So
I have to say, you know, from someone who's never designed a game, I appreciate you posting those things, because I do read through it, and it's interesting to watch the development of it.
See, the problem now is that we've just teased this for everybody else, except that stuff's all under the covers, where you can see it because you've got admin rights, but nobody else can see it except like Tolstoy, because he's doing the design work with me, and that's it. Like, you guys ended up being accidental viewers of that it's not that I don't appreciate you looking, it's that, you know, we wanted to sort of keep a lot of it under the covers until it was a little more ready to get out there, since we're sort of working on it along the way.
Can you not knock it out as a vassal mod?
Maybe, but
you've got people like Vance who does a lot of work in vassal.
Yeah, and Stags had actually done some vassal work for me for something else in the past, and then we never really got it working. Part of it is I've gotten Vassal installed, and I've got like one game loaded on it in the past, and that's it. Like, I've never really done much with Vassal. Right now, I really want a physical set of components that I can push around on the table for myself, just to go, okay, yes, this makes sense, or oh no, that's not the way I intended this to look at all. And to at least, like, this, we are so far from actually playtesting to try to break the game that's not even a consideration at this point. It's, we've got a bunch of ideas. Let's actually see if the ideas even work the way they're supposed to before we start trying to figure out if they would work in ways they're not supposed to. Like, let's get the happy path right first before we start working on branches and sequels. And so that's going to need to start happening soon, because we've got a lot of ideas and we're just sort of iterating on the ideas. But now it's time to finally create some concrete components and sort of see what happens.
Well, I have to say it, not Vassal, but I think Tabletop Simulator would be much better environment for those things. Yeah. And if you need help there, I certainly know someone who has a lot of experience, having just done something called, what was it called? Some campaign. Oh, the Shell campaign. Yeah. And so putting these things into Steam, it's not that hard. Into a Tabletop Simulator, it's not that hard to do.
Well, so I'm at the point now where I haven't even fully created everything, just, you know, the bare bones minimums. There's a bunch of ideas that have been discussed, but you know, aside from, hey, this is what would go on a couple of the cards, like counters, there's a set of counters from a previous version of this design like 15 years ago, but not updated to match some of the newer ideas we're kicking around. So that's all something that absolutely has to change. And I'm just not to that point yet. I'm getting there, but I'm not there yet.
It sort of gives you a real insight into the problems that are faced by, you know, companies, publishers, and designers to create a game, doesn't it? You know, you realize just how much is involved.
And the compounding fact of all of this is we're intentionally not building this around any existing battle or any known battle. The whole point of this is to give people an insight into the planning processes and the C2 processes once the battle's going on, in much greater detail than just, oh, that guy's out of radio range. Like, we want to really get into how challenging it can be to put the plan together, to modify the plan as you're developing it, and then actually you know, execute the plan. And when you suddenly got to start making changes from the plan, you know, bad things happen. Yeah. And, but you know, you have to change the plan because you have to react to the reality on the battlefield. And so that we didn't get bogged down in a ton of arguments with people about, well, that's not actually the correct doctrine for 1987. That changed back in 1985. Yeah. Like, we didn't want to get any of that crap. So we're intentionally building this first run around a bunch of hypotheticals just to make sure that the engine works.
Right. Yeah.
And so we've got to get there first. And then see where we go. something we have said that we need to be doing on the podcast. So folks that have been listening this season know that we have started a Patreon. It is patreon.com/armchairdragoons. And we've got supporters at a couple of different levels available to us on the Patreon. So we've got them just the bare bones minimum, $1 a month. We love you. Like anything that comes in through that Patreon helps keep us on the air and keeps the site, the hosting and registration and stuff for the site moving so that we can keep that going forward, and will eventually help us, sort of spiff out some of the offerings that we've got available, especially when we get around to some of the later conventions coming up. And at the $10 a month level, not only do you get early registration for any Dragoons events that we do, like our summer convention when we do our next online convention, but we also threaten to give you a shout out by name on our podcast here on our broadcast. And we've actually got three of those folks this time around. So Patrick Garrity and Kevin Bertram and now Treb Curry. Thank you all very much for your support of the Armchair Dragoons. Those folks are all at the higher end. If you're interested in supporting us through the Patreon, we love you to death. Feel so inclined. Patreon.com/armchairdragoons. And you too can hear your name shouted out here on our podcast. Big sloppy, wet thank you to those supporters. We really
absolutely appreciate. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. We love you guys. We love all our supporters, but we promise to love you guys by name. And so that, that is great to hear. Guys, I know this was very impromptu, and it's sort of a weird hour for when we normally record our podcast, but I'm glad it worked out because we were able to get Bob on here before the sleep meds.
Yay!
Yeah, very good.
So thank you, Bob, for being able to join us.
No,
absolutely. Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure for Bob to be here.
And and thank you, Mike, for being crazy enough to suggest, hey, why don't we just do it in the afternoon and we get Bob on?
Why not?
Indeed, why not?
Honestly, the thought had occurred to me that we could do an afternoon one and get guys like Jan Heineman or get JD on one of these things finally, get Bob on here.
There you go. Yeah.
You know, to get some of our European brethren into the call. Sooner or later, we'll get Iski on here. It'd be nice to have him join us one of these times. So maybe we do afternoons a little more often instead of trying to cram these onto a weekend somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, I understand, you know, from my point of view, it's difficult with the time zone differences that we can't always do these sort of things as often as we would otherwise have liked. But when we can do them, it's very gratifying because it does make you feel a bit more connected.
And we like to try to do them at least once a season. I think last season just the weekends we had available, you didn't, and vice versa. I think that's sort of what worked out. It's okay. We got you here now, and we appreciate it.
That's right. We do.
Smushing. Yep.
So, in the meantime, audience, pop into the forums, jump in our Twitter feed, wherever you want to slide into there, and come hang out with us. And we've got some fun new stuff coming up over the next couple of months with we've got some short interviews with some designers and folks that we've now reached out to that we're starting to share a little bit of that. Mike's got plenty of My Own Worst Enemy queued up to go. I'm still mismanaging Rhodesia in my playthrough of the White Tribe, and so that's showing up on the front page of our site quite a bit. Grognard of the Year, Jim Ozarski, and the Saturday Night Fights gang have committed to playing Quatre Bras in as many different rule systems as they can possibly. Like, they took 4 months to play one battle in one set of rules. Now they're going to take 4 months to play one battle in a whole lot of different sets of rules.
Yes.
And
it took far longer to play the game than did the actual battle itself.
Yeah, darn near. And so,
hand me the popcorn and let's start watching. That's good stuff.
So we're going to have Quatre Bras in varying scales being presented to us. Some of them even correct. And
isn't scale a prohibited word at the minute?
Well, maybe we're trying to balance the scales here. We're gonna have some fun watching these guys go through. And honestly, I'm really fascinated by the exercise, though, because I think it's pretty interesting. Like, we talk a lot about, oh, geez, how many Waterloo games do we need? How many Stalingrad games do we need? But it's rare that we see multiple Stalingrad games or Waterloo games or Gettysburg games exact same thing put side by side for comparative purposes. And Jim is doing exactly that with the Battle of Quatre Bras. And I think they've got 14 different rule systems lined up that they're going to try to tackle.
That's amazing.
because they're also doing mini stuff. They're not just doing They're not just doing Hex and
Napoleon's Last Battle.
There's a whole lot of minis games in there as well, and so it's going to be really fascinating to see what these guys come up with. And so I'm interested, absolutely. And I hope the audience is as well.
Interesting.
Yep.
Well, if anybody can do it, it'll be Jim.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, he's not the
in an entertaining here, way. Other. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, cool. I hope you realize my cocoa's gone cold.
It's just chocolate milk now, Bob. You're fine.
And now he won't be on one of these for another 6 months because of cold cocoa. Yes.
If you had responded to your messages earlier, you could have waited to make the cocoa.
Oh, right, then okay.
That's true.
All right, Mike, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it. Bob, thank you very much
Always
for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate okay. It. Pleasure.
Okay. And audience, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Bye.
Good night.